Audiobook introduction from UFO contact from planet Umo. A planet 14 light years away. A perfect case. Two separate photographers, unknown to each other, took pictures of the Umo ship who had landed and left tripod landing marks. This happened when the Umo group left Earth at this time, when they were afraid of an possible upcoming atomic war in the Middle East in the 70s. This is a case with a high level on the technical information given from Umo, a civilization in the first steps of interplanetary crossing through space. Introduction. Are there extraterrestrial beings living among us on Earth? Events surrounding two spectacular Spanish UFO sightings suggest that this case is a fact. The Umo case is a mystery with plenty of clues along the trail. Whatever the truth, this is in every way a refreshing change from the more usual alleged encounters with people from other worlds. As the Umites themselves explained, we have not come to bring you a new doctrine, as prophets descending from the skies to teach a new physics or mathematics or preach a new religion, or offering you panaceas for your social or patho-psychological ills. Apparently, in 1950, inhabitants of the planet Umo, 14 light years away, landed on Earth. They lived among us for 15 years undetected, establishing their bases and acclimating themselves to our way of life. Then, in 1965, they started to make contact. Initially, they compiled a list of 20 carefully selected individuals, most of them were Spanish. They included a playwright, a police officer, an employee in the American Embassy in Madrid, an engineer, an official of the telegraph office, a lawyer, and two of Spain's best-known ufologists, Antonio Ribera and Rafael Farriols. Many of those on the list were also members of a small Spanish group, the Society of Friends of Space, including their founder president, Fernando Sesma. According to the Umites, those on this particular list constitute the Madrid group, but there are other groups all over the world. Early in 1965, the Umites began to contact the names on the Madrid list, by letter or telephone, to explain the purpose of their mission to Earth. One of the few who has openly described what happened is the engineer Enrique Villagrasa Novoa, who received the telephone call late at night on 28 November 1966. The speaker identified himself as an extraterrestrial being and spoke fluently and intelligently, though in a voice that was both faintly foreign and mechanical, for about 2 hours. He discussed engineering and obviously had an impressively detailed knowledge of the subject. He followed this up by posting on some documents a few days later. Unfortunately, few of those on the Umites list have revealed the details of how they were contacted. It seems the letters were usually typewritten on paper that bore a distinctive mark. Nor do they know how many others the Umites telephoned, nor whether they contacted anyone more than once. All we know is that some of those who had a specialist interest received follow-up documents. One of the problems that besets this story is that there has been very little investigation into vital points. For example, no one seems to have made any detailed, systematic attempt to look into the ways in which the Umites contacted the people on their list, nor why these people should be on the list. In 1969, the Umites contacted a prominent UFO researcher, Antonio Ribera, who had in fact heard about them 2 years earlier when he had been introduced to Villagrasa. Rather curiously, he kept the matter quiet and, as only in 1975, 8 years after first hearing about it and 6 years after being contacted by the Umites, that he spoke out. The Umites suggested to Ribera that their planet may orbit the star we know as Wolf 424. Apparently, it's difficult for them to be more precise than this, because our astronomical references are incompatible with theirs. They claimed that in 1948 they had accidentally picked up a strange radio signal with a frequency of 413.44 megacycles, which they were unable to decipher. Eventually, they traced it to a planet known to them as O'Aga, or cold star of Quadrate. They refer to our sun as Quadrate. The signal was later identified as having been transmitted by a Norwegian scientific research vessel. The transmission took place between 5 and 7 February 1934, and took 14 years to travel to Umo. Subsequent investigation confirmed the presence of such a ship, transmitting on this frequency, between these dates. The Umites were surprised at this evidence of intelligent life on our planet and decided to investigate. 2 years later, in March 1950, a lenticular-shaped spaceship landed secretly near the small town of Lajevi in Les Masses Alpes, France, in a wild and sparsely populated region, well suited to their purposes. The landing went unobserved, and a party of 6, 4 males and 2 females, was left on Earth. They took over a nearby country house, paying its owners to leave, and excavated an underground hiding place as their base. When the story eventually became public knowledge, it is said that the French authorities carried out an official investigation of the alleged landing area. Some reports claim that they found evidence of unusual activity. During their early years on Earth, the Umites had some difficulty in adjusting to conditions here. In the spring of 1967, an announcement was made that an Umo spaceship would land in a Madrid suburb on 1 June of that year. A number of people living in Madrid were contacted by letter and telephone, allegedly by Umites now living on Earth. The Umo spaceship, they said, would take some of the humans back with it to Umo. At 8.20 p.m. on 1 June, the spaceship duly appeared. Marked with a symbol that had appeared on a thumbprint seal on some of she letters, it was photographed by an anonymous witness and, independently, by one Antonio Pardo. Though broadly similar to us physiologically, there were certain differences, one of the most marked being that their fingers were so sensitive to light and other forms of radiation that they initially found it very awkward to use, for example, lift buttons and electric light switches. Unfortunately, our information about the Umites is restricted to what they have chosen to tell us, so that our knowledge of their affairs is very patchy. Consequently, all we know about the Umites' first 55 years on Earth is that they acquired a great deal of information about us and established a secure base for themselves. They certainly were not in any hurry to make themselves known, and when they did so, it was not to any government but to selected individuals, and even then they did not go out of their way to provide incontrovertible proof as to their supposed identity. They explained the reason for their apparent lack of zeal. "Some of you keep saying that we must give you proof. We continue to repeat, until you are tired of hearing, that we are not concerned whether or not you believe us. We can operate much more effectively in anonymity, and we are not going to be so naive as to introduce ourselves to you openly simply to satisfy your need for proof." Their communications were limited to information about themselves and their planet, their way of life and their culture, all very informative, but nothing that could be verified. But then, in the spring of 1967, the Umites told three of their contacts that on 5 June an Umite spacecraft would land just outside Madrid, pick some of them up and take them back to Umo. They indicated the approximate landing site. UFO shoot. The bizarre announcement appeared in the Spanish newspaper Informaciones on the 20th of May 1967, and several members of the Madrid group went armed with cameras to try to photograph the spacecraft. And on 5 June, at 8.20 p.m., as predicted, an Umite spacecraft was seen by scores of witnesses. But the evidence that should have proved that the Umites were who they claimed to be simply confused many people when it became known that there had been a sighting 6 months earlier in the same area, similar in many ways to the 5 June sighting. Why, they argued, had not the Umites announced this sighting beforehand too? The earlier sighting occurred on the 6th of February 1966 in the suburb of Alish to the southwest of Madrid. Between 8 and 9 p.m. an orange-colored disc-shaped UFO had made a brief landing on a farm near an airfield. It was seen by a large number of witnesses, including a group of soldiers, a man named Vincent Orchino who, from his 6th-floor apartment, saw it both land and take off, and a housewife who declared she saw a giant eye looking at her. The most important witness, though, was a motorist named Jose Luis Jordan who saw the object from his car. He stopped to get out and take a better look, then drove on to where he thought it had landed. As he approached, it rose quickly, but he was able to give a detailed account of what he saw. The craft was luminous, colored, and 33 to 39 feet, 10 to 12 meters, in diameter, giving out a steady, muted, vibratory sound. Beneath there were three projections resembling landing gear, and a curious marking, something like the letter H marks were later found in the area where Jordan had seen the landing, and a photograph of them appeared in Informationes. The predicted UFO was seen in near daylight conditions, a little after sunset, in three separate locations in the southwest suburbs of Madrid. The first sightings were over the open grounds. Shortly afterwards, a Spanish ufologist named Manus Leggett published a book which he requested additional information on the San Jose sighting. On 26 August received a letter from a man signing him Antonio Pardo, who described how he his family had been in the area on 5 June had seen not only the UFO but also a young man taking photographs of it. Antonio Pardo also had his camera with him and he too took photographs of the UFO. Alas, in excitement he forgot to take off the lens cap when he took the first two pictures. Nonetheless, he did end up with seven clear pictures, two of which he sent to Leggett. They were very similar to those taken by the anonymous young man. On the landing site they found strange tubes, the site of the Madrid landing of 1 June 1967, the tubes, which were around 5 inches, 13 centimeters long, were filled with a liquid that escaped and evaporated on opening and also contained two mysterious strips of green plastic bearing the characteristic UMO symbol. It is the hope that this important evidence might be of extraterrestrial origin. One of the tubes, together with its plastic strips, was subjected to laboratory analysis. It turned out that the tube was made of high purity nickel, while the plastic was polyvinyl fluoride. The UMO affair is riddled with doubtful aspects. While its supporters argue that it involves more contact with extraterrestrials than any other case before, it appears that the most contact anyone actually had was just a single telephone call. However, there may have been one exception. Between 1967 and 1975, the members of the Madrid group received a letter from a man who claimed to be the UMite's typist. Apparently, he had advertised for work in a newspaper and had subsequently been visited by two tall, fair-haired, respectable dressed men. They told him that they were Danish doctors and asked if he could type out scientific material for them on a regular basis. Initially, all went well, until the day he read the following sentence: "We come from a celestial body named UMO, which is 14.6 light years from the Earth." He took this at its face value and questioned the doctors. Eventually they admitted that they were not Danish doctors at all, but extraterrestrial visitors. To prove their identity they produced a tiny sphere just an inch or so in diameter, which one of them placed in mid-air before the typist. He looked into it and to his amazement saw a scene that had taken place in that same office on the preceding day when his wife, fearing that the Danish doctors might be spies. Telepathic communication. The most significant physical difference between ourselves and the UMites is that, during their puberty, both sexes' vocal cords are so severely affected that speech becomes impossible. Adults therefore communicate by telepathy. The group sent to Earth was selected from the few exceptional individuals who remain immune to this impediment. Other minor differences include the UMites' sense of smell, which is so highly developed that they made an art form out of blending perfumes together so cleverly that we, unfortunately, cannot appreciate these delightful subtle effects. The UMites also claim that our understanding of physics is woefully, bedrotherlig, simple. Although our physicists are starting to research into the fourth dimension, this is child's play to the UMites, who make practical use of at least 10 dimensions and are aware of many more. They also believe that the subatomic particles that our physicists are continually discovering are illusions. Apparently, these phenomena result from the different positions of the three axes that comprise what the Amites call a bosua, their model of the fundamental physical particle. Comment, a Norwegian telepathic person, and alleged walk-in, Tor Alfstad, has got independent info on those particles, which are really not firm but movement patterns, and he calls them microids in his book An Alternative Cosmology. And comment. We continues. The Amo scripts contain a wealth of such stimulating ideas. It certainly sounds impressive enough, but nothing has been substantiated in science on Earth yet. But how long have the scientific ideas been active here on Earth? Take, for example, their ingenious account of how they are able to take advantage of certain aspects of space, which we know nothing of, using folds and warps in the continuum to reduce enormous distances to manageable journeys. According to the ufologist Antonio Ribera, he has seen blueprints of number of useful devices provided by members of the Madrid group. They include a new type of altimeter, a sound recorder with no moving parts and, most impressive of all, computers based on titanium crystals that store information at the atomic level. These devices have enabled the Amites, while on Earth, to collect and store information on most aspects of our civilization. Apparently, this has been dispatched to Amo. If the vocabulary of the Amites is unconvincing, their sentence construction is totally ludicrous. Take, for example, this sentence to Amo do do Amo Amo do do do, which is supposed to mean we have come from Amo and we arrived with our vessel in the south of France. Clearly, it cannot be translated word for word. So presumable its meaning is contained in the combination of sounds, just as the different arrangements of dots and dashes in the Morse code, or the binary code of the computer encapsulate significant information. They use titanium, an immensely tight and strong metal used extensively on Earth, in structural parts of high-speed airplanes such as the Anglo-French supersonic Concorde. The Amites, however, apparently use titanium, in crystal form, to store information at the atomic level in their computer systems. Another interesting thing, a professor in the Faculty of Medicine at Madrid University, allegedly received through the post a small cube that was smooth, black and metallic on all sides but one. The remaining side had a translucent screen. Accompanying instructions told him to speak a certain sequence of vowels, upon which the whole screen lit up, and the professor saw a live specimen of a nerve cell. It is said that the professor filmed the entire incident, but his name has been withheld and the whereabouts of the film is unknown. See, they who overvalue child steps evolution, don't let the good evidence to come out, because man shall learn to think the universal logic by himself, in his own mind, independent of what others say, and in this manner understand for himself, as a cosmic being. Roe comment. Duality is a theme appearing frequently in the Amites' documents. In this one Amo report the information was much more precise. We read therein. 1. The atomic structure of the two universes differ in the sign of the electrical charge. 2. In our twin cosmos there does not exist the same number of galaxies, and those which are in it do not have the same structures. 3. The two cosmoses possess the same mass and the same radius of curvature corresponding to a hypersphere of negative curvature. 4. The two cosmoses were created simultaneously, but their arrows of time should not be considered as pointing in the same direction. 5. Our twin cosmos exerts its influence on our own cosmos. It is the asymmetry of this influence which has shown us that our twin cosmos has another distribution of galaxies. 6. The two cosmoses were born of a double explosion, implosion. Wham and Uwham are to join universes that can never be located because they are not separated by space. They mutually influence each other. See also pictures in this matter from UFO Contact from Calders, on this same website. 7. The galaxies are now moving at an almost constant velocity. 8. It seems logical that if the galaxies are not being moved by a force field, then they are moving by inertia at a uniform velocity, taking into account that they come from an initial explosion of the universe. 9. Our measuring devices are not very precise, otherwise they would have observed a shift of hands toward the red, which is not a constant but non-sinusoidal periodic function of almost imperceptible average amplitude but nevertheless detectable. 10. The interferences prevent the galaxies from moving at a uniform velocity. 11. For this reason, your measurement of the age of the universe is incorrect. 12. Our twin universe is an antimorphous. These 12 statements constitute a sort of puzzle, which has been studied by the above-mentioned specialists. The information is truly rich and precise, which cannot be said of the Abozuo. This specialist has tried to find possible contradictions in these propositions. The first that presented itself was, into what context can the problem be placed? The text alludes specifically to curvatures, which suggests reverting to the theory of varieties, that is, to those curved spaces which are the point of departure of general classical relativity. This is another astounding confirmation of alleged realities not yet accepted by Earth sciences. The first 7 statements above plus number 11 were clearly enunciated, though in slightly different terms, at least to other space-traveling extraterrestrial races, and we have evidence of even more, visiting here at this time. Both of these other ET groups have likewise maintained extensive contact and carried on long technical dialogues on and off with Earth contactees in several different countries on this planet. Both say they have operational bases on Earth, are entirely human-looking, and move freely in our society. Both have evacuated all of their people from this planet in times of great danger, the crises being the same ones for all. And both have resumed contact when the danger is past. As this is being translated, we are in another danger crisis and all have again evacuated their people. The Pleiadian seems to have far more advanced spaceships with Phyrex. Self-repairing skin or covering on their ships and almost instant communication over galactic distances. Their methods in traveling is very developed as they change dimension for hyperspace jumps, traveling at displacements far exceeding that of light, and normally use many more dimensional frames of reference than we. They have marvelous intelligent computers that can process and store information at subatomic level. They have 3D and more imaging apparatus that can penetrate all things, and can reproduce image data many forms. They are fully aware of all our sciences, philosophies, histories, and they have difficulty communicating ideas to us for lack of language concepts on Earth. They are in touch with, and coordinate with, another space-traveling society from an opposite counterpart universe having a reversal of dimensions, the Dull Universe, as they call it. The modern phase of this contacts has been going on since 1964 and 1975. More info in UFO contact from the Pleiades. The Caldasians also have marvelous self-repairing spaceships, instant communication over galactic distances and through the universe barrier. They normally use many more dimensions of reality than we are even aware of, travel at displacements far exceeding light velocities, have super-intelligent super-miniaturized computers, and more imaging apparatus that can penetrate all surfaces and reproduce data in many ways. They are fully cognizant of our sciences, history, philosophy and current affairs in our world. They have difficulty communicating many ideas to us for lack of language. They are in touch with other space-traveling races visiting Earth. They make extensive use of magnetic energy in all universes, and have problems with communication and traveling when sunstorms occur on Earth. But such problems were never mentioned as making any difficulty for the Pleiadians from Era, Semjace's homeworld, but these ETs from Calder say they originate in another universe for which we are their counterpart or anti-universe. The modern phase of these contacts has been going on since 1960. Both of these ET visitors operate as freely under oceans as an air. Neither have heard of the other, Or at least they don't tell it, nor of the Ammo contacts, nor have the Ammas mentioned them. One peculiarity is that all three speak of intergalactic travel as though it were normal. It is the Pleiadians who claim being here longest. They say they are our forefathers, ancestors. The Mysterious Ammo Affair, Part I of Antonio Ribera, translation from the Spanish by Gordon Creighton. The first page of the first English language review on Ammo. Notice that the Ammites initiated their early Spanish contacts with Fernando Sesma, an accepted mystic. It is now fairly apparent that this was entirely in keeping with their avowed policy of not wanting to be popularly acclaimed for what they were. It did not serve their purpose at all to be identified as extraterrestrial visitors and be believed. In the spring of 1967, at my home in Barcelona, I received a telephone call from an unknown gentleman who said his name was Julian Delgado, said he was from Madrid, and said he desired very much to meet me in order to talk of a matter of the greatest interest. We arranged to meet at a centrally located café here in Barcelona, the capital of Catalunya, namely the Bar Cosp, in the Galerías Condal, and it was there that I made the acquaintance of my unknown caller. He turned out to be a young man of pleasant appearance and somewhat nervous manner who, so he told me, came to Barcelona frequently in connection with his business activities. Señor Delgado said he had turned to me because he knew my name already thanks to my book El Gran Enigma de los Platillos Volanos 1 and because the matter he was going to disclose to me was connected with that subject. Then he went on to tell me about a friend of his, Don Enrique Villagrasa Novoa, a civilian construction engineer engaged in public works who, like himself, was a resident of Madrid and who, as he told me, had had lengthy conversations with extraterrestrial beings who telephoned him at his home and offered to send him reports on technical subjects to be indicated to them by him, Señor Villagrasa. Then, a few days later, Villagrasa would receive by post the report for which he had asked, typewritten on folio-size sheets, each page bearing a curious seal marked with a thumbprint and showing an H-shaped form with curving arms with a shorter vertical bar intersecting the horizontal bar of the H. In fact, it resembled the alchemical symbol for Uranus. And thus it was that I came in contact with the disconcerting, irritating, and mysterious business of Ammo, which is still going on, in 75, and which I am still very far from having got to the bottom of. But let us take it as it developed. Gradually I began to gather together the various parts of what was to become a complicated puzzle, and before me there arose this initial picture of the problem, since about 1965, so it appeared, a group of some 20 or so persons, the majority of whom lived in Madrid, with one in Valencia, two in Barcelona, and possibly one more in Bilbao, had been receiving the enigmatic Ammo reports through the post. From what my valued friend and collaborator Rafael Farriols and I could ascertain, this group turned out to be a cross-section of the population of Spain, in which were represented people who for the most part were engaged in liberal activities, a well-known playwright, an engineer, a young lady employed in the American embassy, an official of the telegraph department known for his interest in extraterrestrial studies, a lawyer, etc. Subsequently Rafael Farriols and I myself also received communications from Ammo. The San José de Valdera's UFO photographs. Rafael Farriols and I, Antonio Ribera, investigated in due course some UFO sightings which occurred in Madrid on February 6, 1966. And June 10, 1967, and which would eventually result in our book, written in collaboration and entitled Un Caso Perfecto. The disconcerting thing about it all was that, several days beforehand, the mysterious gentleman from Ammo had announced to three of their Madrid correspondents the arrival of the machine scheduled for June 10, 1967, and even gave, with striking accuracy, the geographical coordinates for the spot where it would land. About 40 people, present at a gathering in the Gafa Leon, where they were wont to meet to hear Professor Fernando Sesma, president of the Society of the Friends of Space, gave their written confirmations that, on the evening before the day on which the landing took place, they had already read the announcement of its forthcoming arrival.